disaster relief. We do not have a division report on this bill. There is a spreadsheet attached, and Senator Langsdorff, I understand you'd like to proceed from a delete everything amendment.
I do.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that.
Do we have? And I think we, yeah, that's in the packets. We'll work off of that. The A1 delete everything amendment. All those in favor of the motion by Senator Stump, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Langsdorff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, most of this bill was put together by the administration, and it was patterned after the southeastern Minnesota floods. There's a number of different provisions in here, several different departments. But and then also we have $50 million for the flood prevention. That is in the main bonding bill now, but I wanted to get it in with this bill and get it out on the floor. But at this time, I think I'll have Chris Ide, the Disaster Relief Director in Public Safety, explain the different provisions in the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Ide, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And the bill you have in front of you is, as Senator Langsdorff said, modeled after the special session bill of 2007, and then was created last year in the legislature as Chapter 12A, which is a framework for natural disaster relief when we have a presidential declaration of a major disaster. As you all know, starting March 16th and continuing, we are having flooding in particularly the western and the northwestern portions of the state of Minnesota in record proportions. As of yesterday, we've had 28 counties in the state declared a presidential declaration of a major disaster. And those include Traverse, Wilkin, Clay, Norman, Polk, Marshall, and Kitson in the Red River Valley. In addition to that, with the tributaries and inland flooding and also severe ice storms in the Arrowhead, we then have added on Grant, Manoman, Ottertail, Pennington, Red Lake, Roseau, Wadena, Becker, Beltrami, Chippewa, Clearwater, Douglas, Hubbard, Lackey Parle, Lake of the Woods, Pope, Stevens, Swift, Yellow Medicine Lake, and Cook. And we also have a presidential declaration at the White Earth Reservation. We're currently have individual assistance declaration of a major disaster in four counties, that being Traverse, Wilkin, Clay, and Norman. And we are continuing to do damage assessments in additional counties for individual assistance and have completed Beltrami, Clearwater, Marshall, Polk, and are starting to do the Red Lake Reservation. Thus far, our damages that were determined by a joint state, local, and federal teams is about $27 million in public damage. In addition to that, with the massive amounts of temporary flood projects in the area, we determined that it was to the benefit of the local governments for the state to request direct federal assistance in removing all of those temporary measures, including clay and earthen dikes and sandbag dikes, which also costs about $10 million to do that through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. For public assistance, it runs anywhere from overtime for your emergency workers to damages and repairs to roads and bridges and building facilities and parkland and private nonprofit utilities is a big consumer of the public assistance projects, in addition to debris clearance. The estimates of these projects are simply that. Some of these projects take years to complete, and with overruns in that length of time for inflation and possibly changes and tweaks to the project, those are reevaluated and possibly made eligible. So this money that we're talking about is an estimate, at this time, and Homeland Security and Emergency Management historically comes in every session for a deficiency bill, and we appreciate that that was passed earlier in this session so that we can make sure that local units of government are reimbursed. From our family and individual status, as of close of business Monday night, we've had over 850 people, families, that have registered with FEMA. And actually, we have had 645 of those families already receive their inspections, and about $1.5 million dispersed to those families from FEMA. FEMA does cover the temporary housing and some of the repairs to the homes, and then any other needs that are in addition to that, that for those families that aren't eligible for the Small Business Administration loan, is considered other needs assistance, and the state also picks up 25% of that. The bill you have in front of you is are those agencies that are part of Chapter 12A, the framework for response. And this bill supposes that that the state will pick up 25% of the non-federal share because it is such record proportion flooding up in particularly the Moorhead and Clay County area. Just walking through the bill, the public safety appropriation of $9.180 million is that 25% match, non-federal match. Some of the funds that are in this will be to pay for those state agencies such as DOT that has eligible costs, eligible projects, and then we, Homeland Security Emergency Management, pay that 25%. Also for the costs incurred by local government and state agencies to respond, such as the $2 million approximately that it took the National Guard to respond on state active duty, we also pick up 25% of that, and the federal government picks up the other 75% of that. Some of the funds are not eligible for bonding. Only the bonding goes, to repair those buildings and roads. But some of the other things, like the costs of responding and the emergency protective measures, are not eligible for bonding. So that money must come from the general fund. The Board of Water and Soil Resources, you'll notice, is $2 million. $500,000 of that is for the Reinvest in Minnesota Conservation easements. And these estimates were all developed, and the language in the sections were developed by the agencies themselves. We Homeland Security Emergency Management, thank you, Senator, we coordinated this with the governor's office. Also under Bowser is a Red River Basin Commission grant, so a $500,000 grant to the Red River Basin Commission to develop a plan. And that's one of the most important things that we do in disaster relief is we do what we can to prevent future disasters or to reduce the effect of future disasters. That's an important issue to FEMA also. So part of our public assistance money is also for those projects that are eligible to do a little bit more to create, to prevent the same damage the next time. Some of our individual assistance money is also for individual mitigation projects, such as hanging your water heater or putting it on another level, putting your furnace on another level, elevating around your home. Those are the types of things that through the individual assistance program are eligible for mitigation. So one of the $50 million here that you see for the DNR is also for that type of mitigation. We are limited from the HSEM program through the Homeland, through the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program to 15% of the public assistance damage will come into the state for mitigation projects. And those mitigation projects are not restricted to the flooded area, but they are eligible for statewide projects based on the state mitigation plan and where the priorities have been placed. So part of Bowser's money is also going to some of that type of thing. Education for the $173,000 was an estimate they received from those districts that were affected. Loss of pupil hours for the damage to facilities that may not have been covered by their insurance or may not be FEMA eligible are also part of this appropriation. Excuse me. Through Employment and Economic Development, the Minnesota Investment Fund, we have the Minnesota Recovers Task Force. Indeed is a big part of that Minnesota Recovers Task Force, along with a lot of these agencies that are in this bill. And the Minnesota Recovers Task Force determines on application from a community as to where some of this money is spent. So it's assumed that about 200,000 of that will go to help businesses in the flooded area. Housing finance, the $2.7 million is for the Quick Start program. You may remember that program from the Southeast Minnesota floods. So it's a maximum of $30,000 for forgivable loans from upon the application from the families. The revenue, Department of Revenue, is for loss of the net tax capacity due to floods, and that's approximately $250,000. $200,000 for the Department of Human Services is to ensure that there is money to cover the expenses of evacuating, relocating, transporting, and payment of care attendance for those folks from the nursing home assisted living facilities that were evacuated for those patients that may not be reimbursed from Medicaid. And we do have people from the agencies that can answer technical questions on those. $2.9 million for the Department of Transportation. $200,000 of that is for the operations and maintenance. That's mostly for the diking and for the sandbagging on the highways that FEMA nor the Federal Highway Administration may cover. It was part of an entire series and system of diking, but sometimes our federal partners don't agree with each other, and that $200,000 is for the reimbursement to MnDOT for expenses they already incurred. $2.7 million are for those state trunk highways and bridges with damage that also would not be covered from the Federal Highway Administration or FEMA. Natural resources, the flood mitigation grants, $50 million, as Senator Langseth said, it's in the bonding bill, but he wanted to move it to this area, and it will prevent future losses in the areas that you can see on page 9. The bond sale expenses and an appropriation reduction, which I believe Mr. Watson could probably answer a little bit better than I could on this one. Some of the language changes are to ensure, like I said, with the Human Services Department, and the language for the flood loss for the city replacement aid. And then the final Article 2, is $350,000 to go to the city of Hugo for unreimbursed cleanup costs that city had because of its May 2008 tornado. Are there any questions?
I would like to take some time to explain the $50 million. Since the 1997 flood, there's been quite a lot of money spent in the Red River Basin on flood prevention. The flood this year at the Moorhead Fargo was 1 foot and 3 inches higher than it was in 1997. In 1997, was estimated to be about a $4.5 billion disaster. Quite a bit of that was in North Dakota, Grand Forks, for example. But then up in Senator Stump's district, East Grand Forks, the town was almost destroyed, and Warren, Minnesota, as well. Even though this flood was far worse at Breckenridge, which was very, very heavily damaged, was not damaged at all. There was more water coming into that city this time than there was in 1997. The crest was a foot and a half lower. They've got a bypass that's been built there. They're just about completed with their dike system. There's some temporary dikes that need to be replaced with permanent dikes. But this disaster this time caused a very small fraction of the damage that it did in 1997, even though it was worse. So the money has been very well spent. We have got our money back several times just on this one disaster alone. And what we need now is to move along further with the $50 million for these flood control projects. You know, there's an area north of Moorhead called Oakport. It's being annexed by Moorhead. I think about half the houses that were damaged this time in the entire Red River Basin in Minnesota were in that area. So we're hoping that we can, within the next couple of years, we can have them protected as well, so that in the future we will have virtually no damage. And another thing that is being done, and a lot of people say dikes and bypasses and so on don't solve the total problem. There are many water management projects where they have large impound areas to take in water and hold it back and slowly release it over 12 months. The North Ottawa project southeast of Breckenridge, for example, is going to take in 73 square miles of water. That would have been the case this year, except that last fall it was so wet, a lot of those ditching into that impound didn't take place, and I think it was only about 19 square miles. There's many other of these projects. One up by Warren, the Agassiz project, there's $2.5 million would come out of this 50 to finish that. So, and then there's many smaller projects around to restore wetlands. And so on 2 miles from my farm, there was a small project that holds back water on some Nature Conservancy land and lets it out. So
quite make sense.
Just building dikes does not solve the problem with washed out roads and bridges and all this sort of thing. But we are moving more in the future towards water management, and part of this $50 million will go for that.
And, Senator Langseth, let me ask about a particular section of the bill, Section 15, the human service section. I can't quite follow it how that's being paid for. There's a subdivision 3 that talks about source of payment that we seek federal cost sharing. What happens if you know, the waiver is not granted, we don't get the federal cost sharing?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. Senator Cohen, to your question, the original law that we're amending in this bill was enacted last session, and it was written at that point talking about costs that will be paid through medical assistance. So that part of the costs that will that have been incurred in the disaster area and that the department will be reimbursing, that's covered in the medical assistance forecast under current law. The difference here is that we have now identified that there could be situations where there's some folks in the facility who are not medical assistance clients. And in that case, what this language would do is say that we will pay for them with state 100% state funds. That is the reason for the $200,000 appropriation at the front of the bill. That's the connection there. The $200,000 is to pick up state funds where we won't be able to claim federal reimbursement.
And you expect that would be sufficient, the $200,000?
County language.
We, as the senator and Ms. Ivey said, the situation is developing. We are We are getting every day new information. At this point, we think it's sufficient, yes.
And in terms of the medical assistance forecasting, how have you factored that in to the forecasting where this has just been ongoing in the last several weeks?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the MA forecast, all of the DHS forecasted programs, we work under current law, so we would, as I tried to explain, we looked at the statute, the 12A10 statute,
okay,
that was enacted last year. So when we did the November forecast and the February forecast, there's sort of a margin built in for a nameless disaster, I guess, not knowing exactly what would happen in a given year. We have some recognition that there might be some pressure on the MA program.
Okay, thanks. Senator Higgins?
Section
13,
$10.5 million
reduction from something. You know what?
That would be the tax
I can,
bill.
Pardon? Yeah. Let me. I'm going to ask Mr. Mossman just to. That was the section. Senator Bach mentioned that on the floor, but to make sure we all have the proper answer. Mr. Mossman, did you hear Senator Higgins' question?
I did not hear the question, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, if you could repeat.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mossman, or Mr. Mossman.
Whatever.
Got the upgrade there. Section 13, a reduction from House File 2323, Article 15, Section 15. I was just curious about what that was and how that all worked.
Article 15, Section 15 is a provision in the Senate bill that was put onto the House file that appropriates $161 million for job creation activities. It appropriates the money to the Commissioner of Finance. And those activities weren't specified in the bill, and so the language here would reduce that amount by the $10,503,000.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay, but I don't want anybody to get any ideas. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Langseth, a few weeks ago I read in the paper how there's a problem with FEMA because apparently the Minnesota side of the Red River comes out of the Chicago office and the North Dakota side of the river comes out of the Denver office, and there was some disconnect in where the FEMA funding timing of the money was going. And obviously there isn't anything we can do about, but do you know if this is still a problem, and does this affect the ability for us to leverage the money in a timely manner?
That has always been somewhat of a problem. Like the Fargo-Moorhead area and Wahpeton and Breckenridge are really one community, and yet they're not only two different states, they're in two different regions. Now, one of the problems is that it appears that the state of North Dakota will qualify for 90-10 funding from the federal, and Minnesota would be 75-25. Back in 1997, we made the case to the federal people that it was the same flood on both sides.
It was confusing.
They ended up giving us 90-10. But I think these figures are really based upon 75-25. But as far as the timing, there's a problem. And also, there's always a problem that they consider North Dakota to be a small, poor state and Minnesota to be a large, rich state. And they sit there with $1 billion in surplus, and we got $6.4 billion problem. So that isn't entirely the case, but it has caused some problems in timing and also this 90-10 versus 75-25. But I think this is based upon 75-25, so it can only get better. Whether well or not, I'm not sure.
Maybe that works better. It's the whole thing.
Chair?
Yes. Sure. Senator
Mitzel. Small technical change on page 6, lines 6.30 to 6.31. I believe the intention was that the Commissioner of Employment Economic Development would be reporting both the chairs and the ranking minority members of the Senate Finance Committee, the House and Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Watson, did you hear the comment?
Page 6, lines 30 to 31, the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development should report the chairs of the Senate Finance Committee, the House of Representatives, Ways and Means Committee. I believe that it was also intended to have the ranking minority members to get the report as well, too. What is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, this is just language that was copied from September of 07, and if now it would be appropriate to include the ranking members, we can certainly do that.
I'll defer to the ranking member. Senator Frederickson, do you want it?
Senator Betzel, yes.
Mr. Chair, I would move to include the ranking minority members as part of the recipients of the report on page 6.
So do you have the language you would add?
I think the page 6.30, I think after the word chairs, add and ranking minority members. I think that would be what you'd want to do.
All right. We have Senator Betzel's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. We've got an updated. It's not a fiscal note, but I'd like to have members take a look at this before we vote on the bill. We need copies made. Are there questions while we're getting copies made and distributed? Are there other questions for Senator Langseth or Ms. Ide? Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, if I could wander off off this bill just a little bit. I know that Ms. Ide is head of Homeland Security Emergency Preparedness, and maybe she could talk a little bit about the statewide work that's going on in preparation for any bird flu that might be going on. If you just want a little update on that, because I know that...
Sure.
Oh, not bird flu. Pig flu. Swine flu.
Swine flu. There's a difference.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I'd be happy to address that. We as always are communicating with our state, local, and federal partners on anything that is happening. The with the probable case in Stearns County in the Ricori School District, I believe Ricori Middle School actually. We are in constant contact with the Department of Health, who's the lead technical agency on this. We're in a monitoring mode, as we say in the State Emergency Operations Center, and we'll be determining whether we will partially or fully activate once we get a confirmed case. We are part of daily conference calls with CDC and with the Department of Homeland Security. And with the other agencies that are affected by the H1N1, they're asking us now to call it instead of swine flu because it's confusing people. You can't get it from eating pork, so we want to make sure that people understand that it is a milder version of what we were planning for with the worst case scenario for H5N1. Our emergency operations plan that was built specifically for H5N1 was based on the 1918 flu, and so therefore some of those activities are being addressed at a lower level. We are in Minnesota Response Phase 2. If anyone would like to go to our website, hsem.state.mn.us, and take a look at what activities the state government, businesses, and local governments are doing at a Minnesota Response Phase 2. So as soon as we get a confirmation of a case in this state, we then go on to Minnesota Response Phase 3. And we will do the activities that are in response phase 3. But we just want to make sure that people wash their hands and cover their cough and stay away if you're feeling ill. Isolate yourself.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Fishbowl.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Ide. I'm sorry, Ms. Ide. My Ricori is in my district.
So I've been actually, as you were talking earlier, I was reading emails and reports regarding. Yeah, and I'm just, my understanding from the newspaper and from the reports I was getting from the school is that they'll know within 24 hours if this was an actual case.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they should see the samples have to be flown to CDC as of this point. Once it's spread across the whole country and they can't keep up with it, then that will change. But right now, in order to confirm the case, it does have to go to CDC, and it was sent there in the middle of the night.
And is there any sense of the transmission in terms of what the origin of it was?
I have not heard what the origin was. But there has now also been, unfortunately, a confirmed death in the state of Texas in a 23-month-old child.
2 years ago, the governor had requested a significant appropriation for avian flu. Is that appropriation, has that been carried over where it's still available, or what?
There are no tails on that appropriation.
Okay, so that's been used. Are you planning to come for some kind of deficiency or emergency request during the session?
I would have to go back and actually discuss it with the administration and with the Department of Health and the other state agencies what we intend to do.
Obviously, we've got a couple weeks to go in the session, so if there is a need for that, and obviously with some significant financial pressures facing the state, depending on what you may or may not need to do, would certainly hope you could do that within the next several days.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Weeks, 19 days.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to make one comment, kind of general comment, about floods in the Red River Valley. We've heard that this is farm-related. It's the ditching from farmers and so on that causes human activity has made a difference, but the worst flood they know of in the history of the Red River Basin was in 1826. There were no farms, there were no ditches, there were no roads, and so there's more to it than just farmers ditching. We're trying to counter that with these holding areas and so on, but the Red River Valley is very unique. It flows north, and as it's melting in the south, it's frozen in the north. And I don't know if we could somehow dredge it out and get it all into the Minnesota River, maybe. I don't know.
Good luck with that. Good.
You know, it's kind of interesting in Browns Valley, which had that big flood. Part of the water from this little town goes south and ends up in New Orleans, and part of it goes north and ends up in the Hudson Bay. And that's the dividing line. And you see one stream going this way and one going this way.
I'm going to ask Mr. Mossman to go through the fiscal note that he's prepared relative to the bill. And there are a couple of potential, not problems, but Mr. Mossman and Mr. Nauman have been talking about the possibility that a small part of the appropriation will not be needed. I might have Mr. Nauman speak to that in a second. And there might be the need for a technical amendment to the bill to conform with how the money is laid out. So, Mr. Mossman, do you want to?
Mr. Chair and members, the sheet that was handed out, first of all, should say Senate File 2113 instead of 2013. I apologize about that. The appropriations follow pretty closely in the bill. They're easy to identify in the bill, and this just lays them out into columns so that you can see where the general fund appropriations are, which provisions have that versus trunk highway fund bonds, and general obligation bonds. By state agency, obviously public safety, the 5280 from the general fund. And I won't read through all of them. The one item of note is for the general fund to be in balance. I believe that an oral amendment on page 10 of the bill, section 13, line 10.20, would need to be changed from minus $10,503,000 to minus $10,653,000.
I'll make that motion.
Okay. Sarah Thomas, when he moves that technical correction, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
That number is shown, Mr. Chair and members, at the bottom under Department of Finance, which is the agency to which the money was appropriated to in the tax bill. In total, if you just look at the bottom totals for the bill, then the net general fund impact would be effectively zero. Some trunk highway fund expenses of $205,000, the trunk highway fund bonds of $2.7 million, and the general obligation bonding of $54.4 million with the $50 million for flood hazard mitigation grants. Mr. Chair, members, that's the bill. The issue with K-12 education, and Mr. Nauman is here, is just simply Senator Langseth and members, that apparently that some of the children, there's about 40 pupil units of migrant students who are already counted in the forecast, and there's some question as to whether or not we're double counting the potential loss of them because they're already built into the forecast and may not be back. And Mr. Nauman, Mr. Chair, might be able to explain that in more detail.
And I assume that's Section 5 on page 5, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, give me a moment. I was working off the original bill. I understand you have it deleted all. Yes, Mr. Chairman, it would be the disaster enrollment impact aid line item. When an occurrence of a flood occurs post-February forecast before the completion of a final budget, we do want to make sure that what we have the opportunity to say, to carry language instructing the Department of Education to count a particular district as they were assumed to be, as their pupil counts were assumed to be in the February forecast. So in this particular case, I think we might be, in a sense, double counting some kids because the forecast did not assume a flood. So that in the case of the Warren Alvarado School District, they're assuming a loss of 40 kids as a result of students of migrant workers that are children of migrant workers that are not assumed to come back. So that would allow you to potentially reduce about $80,000 of cost out of the bill.
So, Mr. Millman, are you suggesting on line 520, where there's a $127,000 appropriation, that be amended to $47,000?
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I think potentially that's what we would do. We do want to research this a little bit more to make sure. And I've been having some quick conversations with the Department of Education. We think that's what's happening. To the extent that you have another step, with your permission, I think we'd like to delay until the next step. I just wanted to make sure the Finance Committee was aware of that.
Okay, well, I think the next step is on the floor.
Okay.
Is that correct, Senator Langseth? And I think your intent was to take it up pretty quickly.
No, Mr. Chair, we can't pass it over to the House. They have to pass first. But sometimes what I've done is taken up on general orders and got a vote. There's no particular reason to do that now. And we do expect these numbers to change a little bit. So we kind of want to I'll wait and see how the House moves over there, and at the proper time we can figure out what those numbers actually will be.
We should have them by the end of the day, I would think.
Well, with this amount, that could be done very quickly. But
okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for Senator Langseth? Further debate?
Mr. Chairman.
Motions, Senator Tomasoni.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, because of the appropriation from the tax committee, there's nothing for us to adjust in our committees. Is that correct?
No.
It's not correct or no is the answer?
Pardon?
It's not correct or no is the answer?
No, you're not adjusting anything in your committees.
Okay. All right. Then I'll move the bill then, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mossman, you have another amendment relative to Senator Tomasoni's committee? I didn't catch that.
No, it's not.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, one other just quick technical number. On line page 2, line 15, the amount on page 2, line 15 should be delete $25,500 and insert $26,000. And on line 20, delete $9,154,000 and insert $9,154,000.
I'll incorporate that in my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Tomasoni moves the that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Now we have Senator Tomasoni's motion that Senate file 2113 as amended be recommended to pass. Sir Langseth, you weren't looking to have this go back to your committee, were you?
No. Out on the floor.
Okay. So the motion is that it be recommended to pass to the floor. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Langseth. Ms. Heidi.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that people up in that part of the country deeply appreciate what the state has done in the past. It has made so much difference already, and hopefully we will kind of get this under control in the next few years. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Latz, Senate File 1011. We have a delete all amendment. And I think we have not a formal fiscal note, but we have a note on the claims bill. First, Senator Higgins moves adoption. There's not a division report. Senator Higgins moves adoption of the 0443 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Does everybody have?
I've been a member of the claims committee years and years ago.
Okay, Senator Latz. And
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the annual claims bill. The claims committee, a joint House Senate subcommittee on claims, had a number of hearings. We heard some very lengthy and controversial claims that came to us because of the increased knowledge of the claims committee following the 35W bridge collapse last year. But what you have before you is mostly a very routine bill. And those unexpected or sort of surprise claims that came to us in unusual fashion were not approved for any claims. So what you have in front of you is mostly a routine bill. The largest single portion of claims, about $52,000, is the Department of Corrections. Relatively routine payments for people that were injured, either doing mandatory work in Departments of Corrections facilities or on the Sentence to Serve program in various counties where the STS has been overseen by the State Department of Corrections. There are most of those claims are determined based upon either the medical expenses in connection, especially with the STS claims, so it's reimbursement to providers, or it's injuries which are rated according to a workers' compensation schedule, and the dollar amount is then determined in reference to that work comp schedule. There are a number of claims, about 10 of them, a number of claims for STS that were under $500, which are just lumped together for approval.
So, Mr. Latz, Senator Latz, let me ask relative to that a couple of questions. You've got payments for injuries suffered while performing STS work in Hennepin County. So are those people under a Hennepin County sentence, but because they've been sentenced by a state court, the state's responsible for the cost, or?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask Craig Lindeke, counsel for our committee, to answer that question.
Mr. Lindeke?
Well, Mr. Chair, most of the people, including the one in Hennepin County, I don't know if there was more than one, but they are sentenced in the county, and they are sentenced to go out and do work in that county rather than go to the prison or to the jail. And they are on county work crews supervised by county officials. And yet, in order to encourage the counties to put people out on sentence to serve rather than send them to prison, the Department of Corrections is the one responsible for paying if there are injuries to those people or if they incur medical expenses. And many of these are for medical expenses. There's no permanent injury to pay for, but when something happens, somebody has a seizure, for example, one of them in here. They call the ambulance, take the person to the hospital, and this bill pays those medical expenses. but at the medical assistance rate.
Okay. And then there are a number of appropriations for injuries suffered while performing assigned duties at correctional facilities. I take it those are prisoners then as opposed to an employee performing assigned duties.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Sometimes they work in the kitchen, for example, if they cut themselves with a knife while doing the required work in the kitchen, that kind of thing.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I'm just a little bit confused a bit. Mr. Lindeke had indicated that these were not generally permanent injuries, although we use permanent injuries all throughout most of the descriptions under the, in the bill. So how do we determine whether they're permanent or not permanent? Because we use a term, phrase permanent, and maybe that's what's required under the workers' compensation schedule. I'm just need a little clarification there.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
Senator Betzel. I was speaking of the few instances in here for the sentence to serve claims where we're paying just medical expenses. But there are also some sentence to serve permanent injuries, and most all of the prison injuries are permanent injuries. We obviously, the prisons already take care of their medical expenses. So these are just the people who were permanently injured. And, yes, it is for the convenience of the subcommittee, not by any law or anything like that, we do use the workers' compensation schedule. So usually somebody, in every case, a doctor determines that there is a particular percentage of permanent partial disability, and then we pay using the medical, using the workers' compensation rates.
And Mr. Chair, if it's a permanent injury, it's probably a fairly minor permanent injury. If it's like 2,000 or around that frame, I mean, that's certainly not a loss of a limb or anything like that.
It'd be a finger.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Senator Betzel, most of them in the prison turn out to be lost fingers.
Okay.
One finger, two fingers, how many knuckles down? It's a very complicated schedule, but that's what it is.
Yeah, thank you.
Sarah Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about Section 2. It's an interesting effective date. I'm curious why, since it's a lump sum payment of $13,517, it's retroactive to July 16th, 2008.
And certainly, Lance, I interrupted as you were going through Section 1, so you haven't had a chance to comment on the other sections.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Lee Nelson from from DEED is here and can give you a little more specifics as to the need for that retroactive effective date. But this was a rather unusual situation where apparently an employee of DEED gave wrong information to a Minnesotan, and as a result, there was some loss. And DEED acknowledged that, and the money is to come out of other funds. But the claim had to come through the claims committee process for approval. Mr. Nelson?
He's over there. Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, I drafted the bill, of course, and made it retroactive because the Department of Employment and Economic Development has already paid Ms. Tecklenburg. So I thought the best thing to do would be to give them retroactive authority to do that.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, to your question, I have to correct Senator Latz. This went beyond misinformation. The new system in place will not occur again in the future. What happened was in the old system, things had to be processed by hand. And in this particular instance, Ms. Tecklenburg did everything she was directed to do. A department employee, a long-term employee who's in St. Cloud, she had called and asked that her account be withdrawn. He misprocessed that. And so the law wouldn't allow that to occur. And she suffered a loss because our employee mishandled it. And he even typed in what he was going to do. and do it properly, but he didn't do that. The system showed he misentered the whole thing, and she suffered a loss. Had he entered it correctly, she would not have suffered this loss. He took an affirmative action, and she suffered the loss, and the law does not allow us to undo that error. And again, it would not occur under the new computer system, but this in the old system, and she suffered that loss because a department employee mishandled her account.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that answers my question. My question mostly was, why is the retroactive to July 16, 2008? Mr. Linicky gave an explanation for it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Lyons.
Then, Mr. Chairman, with regard to Section 3, this is a rather unusual situation in which a resident of Minnesota who was otherwise qualified for a property tax refund claimed that she had mailed her refund application form, but there had been a series of thefts from post office boxes, from the mailboxes in that neighborhood, and the department apparently never received that request for refund. We were provided in the committee with some newspaper articles and police reports indicating that, in fact, there had been thefts, and there was testimony that the application had been mailed, and including from the individual who claimed to have put it in the mailbox and recalled specifically doing that. So it was the committee's conclusion that under these unusual circumstances that she should, in fact, get her refund. And so that's that basis for Section 3.
Okay. Further questions for Senator Lyons or Mr. Linicky relative to the bill? Let me indicate, members will note that the total for this bill is a little more than $52,000. There's, within the committee, we have a small amount of bottom line money that covers it. Mr. Mossman points out that in the calculations, there's a small error. The amount is actually closer to $53,964.23. But the bill itself is correct, so there's not a need for an amendment. So further questions, motions? Senator Fredrickson?
Chairman, I would move that Senate file 1011 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay, we have Senator Fredrickson's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Lassen. Ms. Linicky.
Thank you.
Senator Marty. Which bill are you
we
doing?
We could do the TEFRA bill, the Senate File 711. Okay. This is probably the quicker of the two, I think, fairly quick bills.
I'll move the committee report, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Betzel moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill now has no fiscal note left in it. This was a bill related to TEFRA, the parent fees for health care for their disabled children. We significantly upped the fees about 4 or 5 years ago. This was a bill that was trying to cut it back by $100 a month for those who had their children living at home. But because obviously the fiscal note in the division that was taken off, but we still wanted to move the bill forward just because of language in the first engrossment. You can see it on page 3, line 5, reimbursements must include notice that the amount reimbursed may be taxable income. And we just want to make sure everybody gets that notice. So we think the bill is worth moving forward with that, but there is no fiscal note to the bill anymore.
Okay. Questions for Senator Marty? Senator Olson.
I'd move the bill.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 711 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
Did we amend it? That was done in division.
Okay. Question has been raised, Senator Marty. Does this need to go to the tax committee?
I don't think so. There's no tax implication in it. It's simply what the individual would be notified of. I mean, the tax committee has not asked for it, I will be glad to go talk with Senator Bach about that. But I think I'd prefer to go to the floor because I don't know that he's really going to care to have a bill. It's simply making sure we tell people that something might be the case.
Well, we have Senator Olson's motion that Senate File 711 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. And then next we have Senate File 1445. Senator Betzel moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1445 is Department of Health housekeeping and technical bill. I have Tom Hindelmeyer here from the department, and there is, I think the fiscal note shows, no fiscal note. There no fiscal impact. There were a couple of fees that were combined into one, the same dollar amount, the same people would be paying them. There's no impact that way that I'm aware of, but Mr. Hindelmeyer is here to speak to the bill.
Mr. Hindelmeyer, would you like to offer some testimony as to what's here? Or
Mr. Chair, Tom Hindelmeyer, Director of the Health Occupations Program at the Health Department, and I can go through the bill section by section or just talk about the particular provisions that have been of fiscal concern.
Well, certainly note the sections of fiscal policy. If you'd like to offer some other thoughts about the bill, feel free to do so.
Senator Cohen, the bill really responds to a number of concerns from practitioners that are licensed by the program I manage, and one of their requests were to combine a surcharge fee with their base license fee, which is affected in sections 3, 4, and 5. It concerns licensed audiologists, and as indicated in the fiscal note, the change is revenue neutral. The bill was amended in the finance division with some technical changes, and so that's the reason it needed to come to your committee. And those are reflected in the committee report. Are there any other questions, Senator?
Other questions from committee members? Would committee members like to do anything?
Move the bill.
All right. Senator Foley moves that Senate File 1445, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Members, I will talk to Tom Bach, Senator Bach, about the tax provision that bill.
Members, one bill left. We've kind of saved the best for last. That's my bill, Senate File 1481. For
Mr.
Several
Chair,
people
I'll move
here.
The budget, the division report for 1481. Who's got the gavel? Yeah, there. Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I'll move the division report for the State Government Budget Division.
On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion prevails, and the division report is adopted. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. Senate File 1481, which has been heard in both the Senator's Policy Committee as well as Senator Betzel's Finance Division. I'm not sure, looking around the several of us left around the table, who all serves on one of those committees. But this bill incorporates the recommendations of the Budget Trends Study Commission.
Mr. Chair, I'm the only one who serves on both, so can I leave?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I tried.
So members might recall that the Budget Trends Commission was established 2 years ago. Had membership appointed by a combination of the governor, the Senate, and the House. Mr. Mossman and Mr. Marks from the House, fiscal staff were participated, were involved in the hearings as well. The commission did a significant amount of work, and I don't know if people have seen the commission report, but the individual commissioners, it was co-chaired by former representative and commissioner Kevin Goodnow and former commissioner Jay Kodrowski, had significant membership. As a quick example, there were four former finance commissioners, Mr. Kodrowski, John Gunyu, Peggy Ingeson, Pam Wheelock. So people representing a combination of administrations. And they came up with a number of recommendations, which has been incorporated in this bill. And members, I can attempt to go through that. And possibly what I'll do is I'll just make reference to the bill summary. The bill itself is fairly straightforward. It deals with a combination of forecasting the budget reserve and the budgeting process. So I should mention the original bill also reestablished the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning as an independent agency. That's been removed from the bill. There's another piece of legislation authored by Senator Clark that incorporates that. So that the bill we have in front of us, coming out of Senator Betzold's division, puts inflation back in the forecast. Now, that's become an issue that we've dealt with extensively over the last several years. And again, I want to make it clear that I'm authoring this bill with a belief that the commission did some very significant work, and the alterations to the commission's recommendations are not significant within this bill. So this was not an intent in putting this section in the bill. This was not an intent to get into a political fight. This was the recommendation coming from the commission. And again, if members, I don't think we've distributed the commission membership. It was very much a mixture. I'm looking at the names. Former Representative Jim Knobloch was a member of the commission. The late Senator John Brandel was a member of the commission. So a couple of former legislators. Ms. Jennifer Eng, and I mentioned Ms. Eng just because, although she's represented a number of interests around the Capitol, I think she began her Capitol career as a Republican staff member of the House of Representatives. So it's a mixture in terms of partisanship, nonpartisanship, and I want to emphasize that relative to the inflation section. Section 2 requires the Commissioner of Finance to consult with the appropriate chairman when making the inflation recommendation. There was significant discussion by the commission relative to demographic trends, and obviously we've had a variety of appearances in front of this committee by Dr. Stinson as the state's chief economist, the person who's most responsible for promulgation of the budget forecast. And the budget forecast is dependent on simply that, the numbers, the economic analysis of where state monies are going. But the commission had a lot of discussion that an equally important part of this is where the demographic trends of the state are going in terms of population growth, lack of growth, types of population, needs of the population. That's not really taken into account when we put together a forecast. So there's a demographic trends analysis. Mr. Gillespie is here, who's a state demographer, and we've had Mr. Gillespie in front of the committee as well, but not to the extent that we've had Dr. Stinson. And so there are sections in the bill that are section 3 in the bill is to include an analysis for a 10 and 20 year period relative to demographic trends so that we can see some of the long range kinds of situations we might incur. Mr. Gillespie could comment much better than I could, but for instance, in 1985, did we have a sense at that point that we would be embarking on the largest immigration influx since the 1890 to 1920 period in American history? I don't recall, as a member of the legislature, I pick out the arbitrary year of 1985, I don't recall conversations of that sort. Maybe at that time that was not predictable, but certainly looking backwards, you know, if we could have predicted some of the immigration influx, or at least as we were looking maybe in the early part of the 90s when that was beginning, we might have looked at appropriations in a different way. So that's a significant part of the bill that I think makes a great difference. There's Section 4 deals with revisions to the budget in terms of timing. There's a structurally balanced provision that indicates that the governor's recommendations must be structurally balanced for the following biennium. Some discussion of that legislation that we had on the floor several weeks ago. You know, I think passing a bill like this takes some of these kinds of issues out of the realm of kind of the back and forth partisanship concerns, and make them concerns for on an ongoing basis. There are significant parts of the bill that deal with the budget reserve and how we build up the budget reserve. Right now in law, it's $653 million, but there's a section of the bill that has the budget reserve growing by 2% and or 2% of the general fund expenditures, and then if the monies are there, ultimately to a level of 5%. That seems to be a recommended amount of money for a budget reserve. Now, that's obviously a pretty significant amount. You can do the arithmetic. If our general fund budget now is, if we end up at about $37 billion, obviously 5% is way beyond what the budget reserve is right now. If we had that kind of a budget reserve, if we had that ability to build it to that level over the next several years, it obviously provides more of a cushion for these kinds of shortfalls. Now, obviously, this year is a very unusual a budget shortfall. But if we had budgeting on a more regular basis, or if we had the more regular kind of surplus versus deficit situation that we've usually had, if we assume and hope we get back into that kind of a situation, then having that larger budget reserve would not have the disruption to our appropriations, as has been the case this year and 6 years ago. And then finally, there are reports and studies. We ask that the Commissioner of Finance estimates general fund expenditures transfers for a budget reserve. So we do look for some information from the Commissioner of Finance in making those ongoing determinations. And also finally ask that the Commissioner of Finance make a report relative to the cash flow condition of the general fund. So these are recommendations coming from the Commission. I'm particularly enthused about the section I mentioned relative to the demographic trends analysis, because I don't think it's something that we have given as much attention to in the past as we ought to. You know, we often hear from Mr. Gillespie, I'll suggest after the fact. This allows us to do more work before the fact, and so I'm particularly enthused about that section. But I do think the Commission did a very good job. I would certainly recommend to members, if you have not had a chance, I think this was the Commission report was distributed to all members, I believe, and if you haven't had a chance to read it, a little bit tough part of the session to do a lot of extra reading, but maybe May 20th you could start reading it, because it's a substantive report. So, well, maybe not May 20th, maybe May 27th.
May 19th, that's fine.
Memorial Day, Sunday.
Senator Cohen, I have a question on page 3 and 4, the budget reserve, and particularly on paragraph 5, where 25% of the budget reserve account went to the budget reserve until it reaches 5%. Why, if when it goes through the priorities, there is additional monies left, why would only 25% of it go into the budget reserve? Why not all that's remaining after going through that higher list of priorities? And if there is, if there's a sum left and you put 25% of it into the budget reserve, what happens to the remainder of that amount?
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking in the report to see if there's a a particular answer. I think that the general answer is that I think the commission recognizes that there are arguably spending needs in the future that might not fit the categories they describe. But maybe, Mr. Mosman, would you like to?
Mr. Mosman?
Mr. Chair, members, I think what the point Senator Cohen was making is correct. I think the thinking of this language here is that the 2% would get the budget reserve immediately to about $700 million, which is it was currently set in law at the 683. So it would get to roughly where the current budget reserve prioritization language in 16A.152 is at. And then in subsequent forecasts that might follow that, where there would be a positive projected balance, this would take a portion of that 25% and keep adding to the reserve until it reached 5%. The remainder then would show up essentially in a forecast on the bottom line as resources available, to which the legislature could add money to the budget reserve or make other choices with the money.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, can you just explain the deleted language on 410 through 12? To what is that referring, that section 16A.15.22?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I thought I'd mention at the outset, this was the establishment of the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning, and so that's in another bill. Senator Clark has a bill dealing with that. And so in the original bill, I had because that was also part of the commission recommendation. I had that incorporated, but it's in a separate bill. So it was removed from this bill in Senator Betzold's division.
Well, so, Mr. Chairman, but the Office of Strategic and Long Range Planning is in 4A01. This one says that to the extent that positive unrestricted general fund balance is projected, appropriations under this section must be made before Section 16A.15.22 takes effect.
Mr. Mosman,
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, 16A.15.22 was repealed, and I think that this is correcting language just to strike what is now an obsolete provision. 16A.15.22 used to be the language that set money aside for an automatic rebate.
Rebate, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And that was repealed earlier.
Senator Cohen.
Last year. I apologize. I had a mistaken reference, so I apologize for that.
Senator Colton, I don't see any other questions from the committee, so what would you like to do with your bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that being the case, I'd move that Senate File 1481 as amended be recommended to pass.
On Senator Colton's motion, any further discussion? We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is sent to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and that concludes the agenda.
The committee is adjourned.
And I think we're scheduled to meet, Friday morning? Is that correct?
For what?
Committee's adjourned.
Friday morning.